Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Folding Pocket.
Welcome to another episode of the Rabbit Hole Detectives, a podcast where I, Dr. Kat Jarman, Richard Coles, and Charles Spencer chase the provenance of historical objects, both real and metaphorical. Each episode, we set one another the task of finding out as much as we can about a particular subject to present a comprehensive understanding of the origin stories of stuff. After all, everything has a history. It just depends on how far down the rabbit hole you're prepared to go. And at the end of it all, our disembodied voice pronounces a winner. Hello again, rabbit holies.
Hello, Kat.
How's everyone today?
Still in sync.
Absolutely in sync now, aren't we? That's the thing.
Like last week.
Yeah. Very good. Well indeed. How are you?
I'm not too bad, thank you very much.
Very good. Are there any Norwegian festivals of note this time of year that we should perhaps be aware of and celebrate quietly with you?
Not really. There's sort of...
The slitting of the monk.
That's any time of year.
Spring stuff. When the tufted saxifrage is blossoming on the fjord.
Into Easter and things. I mean, which is coming up. Obviously, we go skiing. So you go to the mountains and you go skiing and you have a nice time, lots of hygge.
Well, I'm thinking about the religious component, actually.
No, almost like a religious. But you like this one. We read crime fiction.
At Easter?
At Easter. Yeah, it's a tradition.
Oh, that's fascinating, because I wonder if that's a recollection of reading the Passion literature.
And
it's still in Iceland. In Iceland, yes. The Passion stories are still read on the radio, actually. Yeah. So I wonder if that's a sort of secularised version of the Passion stories. It's about darkness turned to light.
In these Scandinoir.
Yeah. So it's called Påskekrim.
It's not. You're making it up. Come on.
Are you really Norwegian? Or are we just being taken for a ride?
No one's ever fact-checked any of the Norwegian words.
That's so true. She just thinks of a name.
Påske is Easter.
Okay.
And Påske.
Oh, Pascha.
Like Pascha.
Yeah, exactly. And Krim, just crime.
Easter crime.
Yeah.
I'm sure that's fascinating. That's a secularisation of the Passion stories.
No, I've never thought of that. I might look into that.
What about Easter at Altrup, Charles?
Well,
Easter egg hunt or something?
Yes, we do a big Easter egg hunt, and my 11-year-old does it on horseback. She's 11, she still believes in Easter Bunny and Father Christmas and all sorts of things, but there we are.
Good for her.
Yeah, it's all good. It's a very big thing, that Easter egg hunt still, yeah. You find them sort of years later, the ones that weren't discovered on the day, just sort of festering and moulding in the grass and in the leaves.
Can I tell you slightly embarrassed about, not embarrassed about it, but I don't like Fabergé eggs.
Well, that is quite controversial. That's a hot take,
isn't
it?
Because actually, I thought I had you down as somebody who appreciated that sort of thing.
Well, you'd think, and if I had the means, that I would collect Fabergé, but I don't like them. Only thing, it's got bling.
Yes.
It's got the connection with a tragic, doomed royal dynasty. It's got rarity and scarcity, and it's got Easter.
But and diamonds. You love a diamond.
They're horrible. I think they're just naff.
Yeah. Well, they're quite overblown, aren't they? But I think you're keeping us away from what happens at Easter at your place.
Well, it's weird because retired vicar. So Easter, of course, was one of the biggest, well, actually the biggest, liturgically the biggest day of the year. So we had loads going on. Mm-hmm. And when you're not a vicar anymore and you're not responsible for putting on the show, you go to somebody else's show. And, of course, you sit there just judging them.
The whole thinking time. That's not very good.
You do that way, do you?
Yeah.
And trying not to look like you're judging them. But I loved them. When I was in the monastery, that was one because we had the proper triduum in the monastery, the 3 days, and it's full on, old school, old time, full fat religion. It was good.
I've got a wonderful friend of mine who happens to be gay called Giles, and I took him to a religious service at Easter. We had a complicated local vicar, and I said, "You're not going to particularly like her." And at the end of the service, we came out and I said, "So what did you think?" And he said, "I just spent the entire sermon praying that Secret Santa would bring us some conditioner for Christmas," which is about, it wasn't quite the point of Easter really. But
kind of in the ballpark.
So we all interpret Easter in a different way, I think.
Yes, well, yeah. That's true.
Yeah. That's so I'm fascinated now about the...
Yeah.
I might do that as one of my rabbit hole topics.
Yes.
Is the Polskrim.
It's Polskrim, yes.
Polskrim.
Polskrim.
Well, when is your vicar series in Norwegian yet?
I don't know.
Oh.
Because you could go and...
That could
fill your Easter.
Yes.
It's in Estonian, which I know is not Norway.
Not quite the same, Richard, but thank you.
It's in Finnish, which is getting a bit
also
nearer.
Also not quite the
but
same,
getting nearer,
Richard.
Well, I Finnish is nearer Hungarian, isn't it?
Yeah, than, it's not nowhere near.
Doesn't Finnish Lapland join onto the top of...
So we have a border, yes, but linguistically it's not similar.
Very different.
So that doesn't really count. But do that, and then you can do a tour, a Porskikrim tour, can you, in Norway?
I'd love to do a Porskikrim. I might write a book, actually. I might have one of the series called Easter Crime.
Yes.
Yes.
Like it. There we go. That's you sorted for your
so
next
Dose
book.
Is doing the Christmas one. It was a Murder Under the Mistletoe.
Mm.
I mean, honestly, do you think these are... Do you come up with the titles?
Teams of people come up with the titles.
I can imagine
there are highly
one.
Paid executives in central London who thought of that one.
Anyway, on to... Our first topic of this week is actually going to be starting with you now, Richard, and you'll be talking to us about glazes.
Yes, don't glaze over with boredom. Da, da, da. I'm going to talk about ceramic glazes in particular because it's a fascinating subject and an enormous subject too. So forgive me, I'm just going to hop like a pond skater across the meniscus of this topic because there's so much going on. What do we know about? Well, we know that they're very early. I think the earliest human artifact we have is the Venus of somewhere unpronounceable. Very, very ancient. You know what I mean, Kat?
Yes. It's another female figure. Yeah.
Could it be 35,000 BCE, something like that? Is that or 28,000 BCE? Something. It's a long, long time ago.
I think it's about 35,000 BCE.
Thank you, disembodied voice. You know, people were making objects out of clay because you found very simply that if you just handled clay and left it to dry out, it would retain its shape, of course. Very early on, people started making vessels or containers out of clay. We think it probably began with people leaving clay in the bottom of a basket, and then perhaps there was a fire and they found that clay baked and had more resistant properties. And then 3,500 BC, all of a sudden, the invention of the potter's wheel. So people started making objects for use. Pots, bowls, cups. What do you need in a jug or a vase or a pot or a bowl? You need non-porosity, okay? You don't want to pour your water or your wine or your mead or your milk into a vessel from which it will leach or dribble. So they needed something to provide a non-porous surface for that stuff. And that's where glazes come in. Discovered accidentally at first, I think, because some of the material in clay had silica in it. And as kiln temperatures began, as the technology of firing began to get improved, then they could raise temperatures in the kilns. When that happens, all of a sudden the silica started to vitrify. And then when that happens, you have a glaze. A glaze is essentially a film of glass that covers the clay base or the porcelain, whatever it might be. And that gives you a number of advantages. One is it means it's non-porous. The other thing means that it become decorative and beautiful. Mm. Colour effects, changes and things. So it came about accidentally first Mesopotamia, and it was simply through higher temperatures in kilns, vessels started producing a kind of slightly glazed surface. And then ash glazes sort of happened because, again, as the kiln technology developed, when they started doing climbing kilns, so you would have an underground little tunnel that went up a little bit of a hill. You'd have firing at the bottom, and then you'd place your pots inside it. The temperature would get higher as you rose through the kiln, and those higher temperatures, sometimes ash would blow in from the firebox into the kiln. And most glazes, traditional glazes, are ash glazes. In Japanese pottery, for example, the Nuka glaze, which is the beautiful, beautiful grey-green glaze that you see, is made from the husk of rice. Wood ash blows in, and at a certain temperature, once you get over about 1,000, 1,100, 1,200 degrees, it vitrifies, and you get this vitrification that happens. What do you need for a glaze? Well, I'll tell you exactly what you need for a glaze. You need silica. So yep. Basically something that will become glass. You need flux, and that is a material that causes it to melt. And you need refractory, and that is something that stops it melting too much. And part of the art of glazing is getting materials that will do all those things, but you have a degree of control over them, so it doesn't all pool or puddle off.
You mentioned the decorative glazing. So was that a late introduction? I mean, presumably at first you're just thinking practical. When does the human leap from thinking, I actually want that to be pretty as well?
It's an interesting thing because what you get with ceramics, as you know, I'm a big ceramics fan, and particularly with glazing, is you get beauty, utility, and affordable luxury.
Yes.
Those are the reasons why glazes became such a big thing, I think. Utility, first of all, in creating non-porous surfaces, and then beauty, because you'd find that those ashes would leave different colours, and because of the chemical reactions that happen in the heat of kilns, and that's the material your clay is made from. And then also they discovered that you could use ash, and then you could do aqueous suspension of minerals, and then you could paint or dip. Dipping was the traditional thing, and you'd find you get all these sorts of lovely effects. Here's an affordable luxury one, okay. In China, before about the 14th century, the most highly prized wares, green wares, we call them, celadon, right?
Oh, yes.
You know that, so you'd see it all the time, that lovely green glaze. It's iron oxide actually fired at a certain temperature. Again, difficult to get right, but once you do get it right, you do get that beautiful green glaze. They liked it so much because it resembled jade. And jade was, of course, the most prized substance you could have in ancient China. So up until the 14th century, which is when all of a sudden blue and white China rather took over, celadon ware, green ware as we call it. And it still is now. It's still a very, very beautiful thing. And very influential. You think of beryl woods ware, the English cups and saucers that you always get in church halls. Why are they that colour? I think it's a reflection of that, the beauty of green ware. So it starts in China, spreads to Japan and Korea. They develop their own very interesting glazes and techniques. And of course, particular to those particular places, Buncheong in Korea, which is very beautiful. That's a very pale, translucent glaze that goes over slip-painted pottery, which is made out of a very dark black clay almost. That's very beautiful. And then it goes up into the Middle East. So you start getting wonderful wares from Mesopotamia and then from Iran and Iraq by the sort of 10th century. And then something very significant happens, which is tin glazing. So you'll have your ash glazes. It'll give you all this variety of beautiful colours, and they have this drip that you
can... I'm sorry to be ignorant. So you're using the ash to do what?
Well, the ash in the intense heat of a kiln melts and becomes a sort of liquid glass. It's the silica.
Yes. Okay, yes.
And it's partly in the reaction with the clay body and the glaze itself. But you will see people sort of patting wood ash in great handfuls over potted forms, them going into the kiln, and they come out with this beautiful... I mean, a great, great contemporary pottery died a couple of years ago, Phil Rogers, who's absolutely the master of ash glazes. He was working at a pottery in Rhyadr in mid Wales. He's the sort of master of that, but it's a very ancient technique. So you can have colours and you can have all sorts of things, and then opacity is a thing that comes along, and that is tin glazing. Tin glazing, really, really, really significant, because that's where Delftware comes from, that's where Englishware comes from, that's where Maiolica comes from. And it was a technique of introducing tin, which produced a white, opaque glaze. And onto that, you could do all sorts of wonderful things. Faience is also known as, named after the Italian city of Faenza, which is associated with that. Interesting, you could track the technique of tin glazing sort of coming up from the east and heading towards Europe, going in actually through Moorish Spain into Andalusia, and then from Andalusia into Northern Europe. So you've got these wonderful Italian makers who are creating beautiful, beautiful... Think of, in art, the Della Robbia family, Luca Della Robbia, 15th century Florentine who perfected glazing earthenware. He was a sculptor, originally, I think, a pupil of Donatello, although that's disputed, but I think he was a pupil of Donatello, one of the great sculptors of his age. But he developed this technique of glazing terracotta. So you get these wonderful opaque whites and then these wonderful colours. And you've seen them all over Italy. These are often done as a sort of medallion shape, and you'd have maybe the Virgin Mary or a mother and child, and then elaborate foliage all around it done in polychrome. Absolutely exquisite, exquisite stuff. And that goes up into the Low Countries, so you get Delftware. You think of the Delft tile.
Yes.
Again, white, it's a tin glaze with lovely blue overpainting on it. And then there's English Delftware as well. The English did their own version of it and liked it so much. Interesting development too, Majolica, which is thought to be come from Majorca. I thought that would be the place in between North African Moorish culture and Southern European culture, so a place it came through. Minton started doing a version of it in the sort of 18th, 19th century called Majolica. Looks the same, but using a completely different method. So don't get your Majolica mixed up with your Majolica. And then the other, I mean, there are all sorts of glazes. Salt glazing became a huge thing. So salt glazing is a wonderful technique. So you fire your kiln, and then again, technology permits these. So once you've got it up to temperature, you literally just throw salt. If you've got a big firing, maybe 50 pounds of salt you throw in through the stoke holes in the side of the kiln. I love a sodium glaze. It's lovely. It's got what's called an orange peel effect. It's a glaze and it seals the pot, but it has this kind of slightly stippled appearance. Beautiful. And it was used for sanitary ware an awful lot. So sewerage pipes, you know, you've probably still seen them. You see them all the time now. Mm. Salt glazed originally. And salt glazed pots, you get them in pubs and taverns and things. Fascinating things are happening with the tin glaze thing. It was an ancient technique. It goes back to ancient Egypt to have glazed earthenware. But you get the great terracotta, glazed terracotta of Victorian and Edwardian England. Think of Birmingham, for example, with its terracotta exteriors. Terracotta, easy to mould, cheap, because you didn't have to hew a lump of stone. You could just have a hollow piece of terracotta, so cheap and light, glaze it, and it was impervious to weather. So you get those wonderful, wonderful terracotta buildings in Birmingham, in Manchester, in Liverpool, ornate and lovely. And among the most famous of them, I suppose, the National Liberal Club.
Oh, yes.
The National Liberal Club in London. I don't know if you know
it. Yeah, I've
been
there, yeah.
But it looks like a giant gents. Mm. And the reason it does is because it's made with a lot of glazed earthenware. So you get that lovely, beautifully finished, shiny, polychrome interior and exterior. It looks very beautiful, I think, and very much of its time. Huge in America. Lots of the Chicago school used it too. So there's so much I could say about this, but I'm going to just go to my favourite fact, I think.
Yes.
Yes, please.
Where would you say glazed terracotta in London is used to most kind of widespread effect?
Would it be the tube or the underground?
Exactly. Very well done.
Well done, Kat.
Well,
thanks.
You know that Song de Boeuf? You think of Gloucester Road.
Yes.
You think of the Piccadilly Line. You think of the Northern Line. Think of Leicester Square. Think of Piccadilly Circus. I'm talking about that oxblood, shiny bricks with the big arches. It's an absolute classic. Made by an architect called Leslie Green, who died actually aged only 33 of pulmonary tuberculosis. But it uses the Song de Boeuf, which is this deep oxblood glaze, which was traditionally an extremely difficult colour to get and highly, highly prized in the courtly circles of Japan. But anyway, so every time you use a tube station, you see that deep, deep dark red glazed terracotta work. Think of an ancient, ancient technique that has been adapted for utility and beauty. I've got another favourite fact.
Come on.
Celadon, where does the name come from?
Goodness, nice.
Honoré d'Urfé. Do you know that name?
No.
He was a French nobleman who wrote, I think, one of the longest novels ever written, L'Astrée, written in the early 1600s. It's a boring French pastoral tale about a shepherd and a shepherdess. The shepherdess is Astrea. A tale taken from 5th century, well, it's Ovid's Metamorphoses, a takeoff of that. But her lovely swain, who's a shepherd, who's after her all the time, dresses in lovely green ribbons, which excites all the maidens of the parish. And his name is Celadon. So they think that Celadon is taken from the green ribbons of Celadon.
That's lovely.
And if you would like, for example, to see what it looks like, if you go to the National Gallery, you will find there, I've got a note written on the back of my hand, I'm very sorry, a portrait of the Baron de Besenval in his study, painted by Danlus in 1791, looking at three Celadon Chinese vases on his mantelpiece. Painted 1791, he was in exile in Switzerland from French Revolution. Those very same three Celadon vases went for 1.6 million quid at Christie's in 2021, I think it was.
Wow.
Sorry, that was a clutch of favourites.
Double whammy. That's good.
Another rabbit hole. That's good.
Daisies.
Excellent. Well, thank you for that, Richard. So
this episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
That brings us on to you, I think, Charles, and you've been researching both theoretically and practically your topic of Tai Chi.
Yes, about a year ago, I was on holiday, and in the hotel, there was a list of services, things you could do. And there were sort of massages and all sorts of lovely things. But one of the things was Tai Chi. And I thought, you know, I know very little about this ancient art of Tai Chi. And I thought, I'll give it a go. And I had a vision, which I imagine most of the listeners to this podcast will have, of quite elderly people doing quite gentle exercises in a park. That's what you tend to see. But the bloke who taught me threw me around, actually, threw me around in our lessons. And I thought, this is very odd. I said, what is this Tai Chi?
So are you
this
sure it was Tai Chi you clicked on?
And it was Kung Fu Tai Chi, which, of course, brings you to the fact that it's not just a medicinal practice, really. It is a self-defense. In fact, to sum up what Tai Chi is, it's a martial art. It involves medical and physical health. It includes a sort of meditative quality. There's self-healing as well as self-defense and fitness. And so for those who are proponents of Tai Chi, they would say it is the complete discipline for people seeking improved health, wisdom, mental clarity, and emotional balance. And yeah, to kick off with a big fact, it is one of the most popular forms of exercise in the world. And there's 300 million participants. It's obviously hugely popular in China, but
I've
it is also
people do it in China in the park in the morning.
It's meant to be one of the reasons that the Chinese enjoy such long and relatively healthy lives. So it's not actually Tai Chi, it's Tai Chi Quan. Mm-hmm. And they are three words which respectively mean supreme, boundary, and fist. So if you were going to sum up the translation of those three in a more simple way, it would be, well, a long way, but it sort of breaks down. It's a method of movement to cultivate a form of power that has no boundary. That is effectively what the Chinese are saying. But to the Westerners, I think we can call it shadow boxing or perhaps moving meditation. And part of it is it's harnessing the qi or the qi, which is the force that circulates within our bodies. So harnessing it and circulating it, this flow of energy. And I suppose in Chinese philosophy, qi or qi is central to understanding the balance and harmony within yourself. It's connected to yin and yang. But what is extraordinary, as somebody who practices Tai Chi, is when you get your qi right, the defensive quality is extraordinary. And the fact that if you are lined upright, if your feet are correct, all of this you need help with. It's a very difficult thing, I would say, for people to learn online. You need it to be so precise. You need a master or an instructor who can say, just move it just that tiny bit.
You say it was related to Alexander technique or Feldenkrais or something like that?
I don't know enough about those two. I know roughly what they are.
Alignment and this notion of a sort of holistic approach.
That would be in tune with it. And the idea that you have forces running through you in lines in your body, I suppose. Yes, if that answers.
I don't really know.
Yeah.
But I'm very conscious of the sort of stresses and strains that accumulate because your back's a bit out or because you've got one leg longer than the other or because of a repetitive, you know.
Well, and misconceptions too. I mean, my Tai Chi guy who I've been seeing, who's my master, I suppose. I went to him thinking that I had problems in my back. And he said, no, I hadn't at all. I'd just been holding my back wrongly. So he has essentially lengthened my right leg by an inch.
Do you think it might be related to your Morris dancing?
Yes, it's a Morris dancing injury.
I think my exploring things like Morris dancing and Tai Chi shows an inquiring mind.
So do I.
And a willing body.
Exactly.
Going into the roots of Tai Chi, it's been linked to figures in the 15th century, 12th century, 9th century. We're not sure if it is the ancestor of what we do and see today, but we can trace it directly to the 17th century when a man, a Chinese gentleman called Chen Wangting, amalgamated the boxing techniques he'd learnt from a distinguished Chinese general with ancient philosophical techniques of Daoyin or Tao. And the concentrated exertion of your inner force. So he produced this with a sort of breathing techniques added to it. The Tai Chi I do, you breathe naturally, but you can have one of the five central Tai Chi disciplines. They're very keen on the breathing. And this gentleman passed it down the Chen family rather jealously, generation after generation. But the most popular style today is one that was stolen from Chen. It's called the Yang style.
Stolen?
Yeah, because the man called Yang Lu Chan in the 19th century wanted to find out what the secret was to the Chen way of doing Tai Chi. So he presented himself at their door as a starving beggar, and they took him in. And he watched through cracks in the walls as to what they did, mastered it, and then improved it, joined the imperial court and taught very influential people how to do this. And he became known. He was so good at Tai Chi. And of course, this is the big leap people have to make when they're listening to me today, is not to think of elderly people moving very gently, but to see it as this martial art. He became Yang the Invincible.
Can I ask a question? Mm. So you go and see your Tai Chi master in
yes.
Duston, just
yes.
on the edge of Northampton.
Yes.
Just hold that thought for a second. What's lesson one?
Lesson one is standing. I'm learning so much each time. He's very clever, my master, and he essentially lets you start with doing very basic forms, which you would recognize instantly as Tai Chi. And he lets me do them and do them and do them. And then now, after 11 months, he's making me move my neck a little longer. And everything is so precise. But the first lesson I learned was how to stand on my feet, where to put the weight, which is sort of across the middle front section, the balls of your feet. And there's a lot of standing. And well, I start with a routine with him most days of a sort of 12 or 15 minute meditative movement exercise. And you're holding a pose maybe for 2 minutes each time or 90 seconds. And what I would say, it sounds so minimal, but because it's so precise and it's come from hundreds of years of thought and discipline, I haven't, touch wood, had any niggles at all for months.
Just make this about myself for a moment.
Yes.
It just really strikes the parallels that now, because I'm playing the piano a lot more
yes.
now, and one of the things I'm doing as a pianist in my 60s is realizing that I have to unlearn some bad habits I got into when I was in my teens and 20s.
Absolutely.
And it was to do with me either trying to find a shortcut or sometimes to get around some unresolved physical tension in my hand or my wrist or my elbow. And I realize now that I've been playing badly for years because I'd never really sat down and tried to solve that problem, the core problem. I'd sort of worked around it rather than dealing with the issue of where I... Sometimes it's simply about the position of your elbow. And you realize that these things can have quite significant
matter.
Effects.
Yes. And I found just in a very basic way, not as precise as what you're talking about, but for instance, I've always been tall. I'm over 6'3" or whatever. My chin's gone forward and sort of stooped a bit. And he won't allow that. You have to stand taller.
Is that because you're talking to people and you're leaning down a bit?
I think it's a sort of apologetic for being a bit tall.
That's interesting.
But anyway, just the stretching of the neck's been incredibly useful. I mentioned earlier how Tai Chi is part of things we may not know, the other martial arts, for instance, but also in popular movies that you would know, like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon from 2000. The two main characters in that are martial artists, and they're both of them skilled in Tai Chi. And throughout the film, the character Li Mu Bai, he uses Tai Chi principles. Those graceful, fluid movements, they're the sort of hallmark of proper Tai Chi. And it's about the balance between softness and strength. I think that's one of the keys to it. And also, one of the keys I've learned to Tai Chi in this limited time is that it's the sort of perpetual motion. The movements don't end in a sort of rigid karate type. It's all keeping the flow going is very, very important. And also, going back further, 1984's Karate Kid, Mr. Miyagi teaching the kid the principles of balance and martial arts. He does that through Tai Chi. And the famous, if you've seen the Karate Kid, you know, the wax on, wax off, which he does for moving the hands and paint the face, those techniques are Tai Chi, actually. They're not karate. Lots of people from the East who are quite famous for their martial arts, so Jet Li and Jackie Chan, they both incorporate it. Both of them use Tai Chi not only on its own, but to help them recover from injury, from their more dramatic exertions doing Kung Fu Karate, that sort of thing. And Stephen Hawking, when he was initially dealing with his motor neuron condition, he used Tai Chi just to get some movement and some comfort from this.
Sounds great.
And it is really a big deal for healthcare, actually. It has therapeutic benefits that have been, it's used by the National Health. If you go on the National Health website, they really recommend it. It's very basic, of course. And it's used to improve balance, reduce falls, and then really importantly, alleviate symptoms of things such as arthritis and Parkinson's disease. It's a bit of an all-rounder. It's good for diabetes, good for blood pressure, that sort of thing. And its principles have been used in business and leadership. The Tao of Leadership, Leadership Strategies for a New Age by John Hyder, was one of the best-selling books of its type at the time. And then even in space, it's used by NASA. They use Tai Chi experts in the training programs for astronauts to help them adapt to the challenges of microgravity, learning to move in very alien conditions. And so my favorite fact is actually something I did know before I took up Tai Chi, is that Lou Reed, edgy experimental rock and roll legend, who had Velvet Underground, the band from 1964 in New York City, it is seen as one of the founders of alternative rock and punk. He called himself a study in reckless excess, but he was absolutely dedicated to Tai Chi for the last three decades of his life.
That's interesting.
And his practice was a testament, really, to a quest for peace and balance and mindfulness. And he had a master, Ren, who's a very important figure in Tai Chi, quite controversial because he sort of went commercial by becoming Lou Reed's right-hand man. He actually would perform on stage to concert goers' bemusement, seeing this man doing Tai Chi in the corner while Lou Reed was belting out one of his classics. But they reckon that Tai Chi's spiritual and physical benefits helped Lou Reed with his famous battles with addiction during his last three decades. And, you know, I rather like the fact that when we're looking at Tai Chi, in October 2013, when Lou Reed was on his deathbed, this godfather of punk had Tai Chi in his mind. He was held by his wife, Laurie Anderson, and he died doing the water flowing 21 form of Tai Chi.
Well, what a way to go.
Yeah.
I have to think you've really sold that to me, Charles. I love the idea of something which tries to address the body,
yes,
not simply as a kind of set of mechanical operations, but as something that's linked to your mind and your well-being. Because I'm really conscious as I get older how kind of, it's really through playing the piano, actually. It's just how kind of knotted I am and how...
It does change you very much. It does change you. You walk differently. So, for instance, you're like me, Richard. You carry your shoulders quite high. You learn to drop your shoulders more. And that's a much more natural pose. And I think, you know, because you're a musician with your piano, you probably kept a lot of tension up there, you know, and it's good to let that go. And also, I would say, I can't meditate. Everyone says, oh, meditation's so good for you. Well, I bet it is. But if you're doing these exercises in a Tai Chi way, I find it's just enough. You're having to concentrate just enough to take the top edge off the noises in your head.
You'll never lose that commentary.
That's right.
You can tune out of it.
You can tune out of the rest. Yeah. And the rest, I mentioned this 12 or 15 minute exercise I do at the beginning of each class. I come out of that thinking, oh, that was a minute. I cannot believe it's been that long because you're in a meditation.
Have you ever fallen asleep in the middle of doing it?
No, because I'm still such a novice. I have to concentrate on every move.
I had to go when I did yoga and I fell asleep.
Yes,
I mean, it was quite good, actually. Quite interesting that it did.
But you were saying about your back, you know, causing you problems. And I honestly, I think Tai Chi is well worth a look for you.
Well, I'm sure in East Sussex, where I live, we've probably got a Tai Chi master in every downland village. I've got three in mine. Yes. Check it out.
Brilliant. Anyway, well, thank you.
And it's Kat's turn.
Do you do anything like that, Kat?
It's my yoga, really.
Just my yoga.
Just my yoga.
So you're a yoga doer.
Downward Kat.
Yes, yeah. That would be me. And yes, yoga and gym, really.
But you were doing gym frighteningly early, you were telling us.
I have started to, yes, because I get insomnia. So I wake up at stupid o'clock and just lie there awake. And I realise that my gym does classes at 6:30 in the morning.
Oh,
and so I thought, I might as well just get up.
Do you know what? I think that might be a thing we three rabbit hole detectives have in common, which is...
waking up really early.
Waking up early, yeah.
Yeah.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Right, but get on to it, because I know you've been waiting for this one, Richard.
Yes,
especially.
This is a real crowd pleaser.
I've been waiting for this for four series.
Yes, basically. I will be talking about dental plaque. Actually, not plaque, but calculus.
Explain that, please.
Calculus or tartar as well.
Yes.
Now, this is calcified dental plaque. So dental plaque is essentially the stuff that you do get on your teeth pretty much every day when you eat and drink. It's a sort of sticky film of bacteria mixed with sugary and starchy food. The stuff that when you can sort of lick your teeth and you feel a slight weird texture when you haven't cleaned your teeth, that's plaque.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you clean that off normally and that's fine. But if you don't clean it off, within about 24 to 72 hours, if you don't remove it, it starts to harden and essentially fossilize. So it's the only part of your body that fossilizes during your lifetime, actually.
Just explain that process. So it becomes hard. So it loses... How does that work?
Yeah, so it calcifies.
Becomes like a mineral.
Yeah, it essentially mineralizes.
Yeah.
So it becomes extremely hard and very durable. So really, you need to properly pick it off or get your dentist to do it for you. So the interesting thing about that is that this is something that, you know, happens to all humans. So all over the world, all time periods, you get people get plaque on their teeth. And then if they don't clean them well enough, it forms calculus. Now, that's very exciting because that calculus... contains so much stuff, basically.
You're the only person I have ever met, Kat, who's excited by dental plaque.
Well, just wait. You will be in a moment as well.
I am already.
Finished. You will understand why. So it's exciting because all of that stuff, that hardened stuff, that sticky film, that's essentially storing everything that goes on in your mouth. So everything that you eat and little bits and pieces that find their way into your mouth, it all gets stuck in that plaque and then it calcifies and hardens and it can last for thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands of years because it's so hard.
So in a way it's useful to someone in your line of work as DNA would be.
It's exactly that. So it's useful because we can analyse it and we can look at exactly what's in it, including with DNA, as I'll get back to in a moment. It's useful for us in the archaeological record, just things like looking at dental disease. So you can see how people are caring for their teeth and whether they're cleaning their teeth, all of that. But that's sort of the most boring part. The most exciting bit is what's actually
in it. Now, we've been studying this for really quite a long time. And initially, it was, I believe, in the 1980s, people started looking at human remains, so looking at people's teeth and seeing these little deposits. Sometimes it's quite noticeable. People have huge, big chunks and it looks pretty horrendous. But people started looking at it under a microscope, realizing there's a lot of stuff stuck in there. And looking at the sort of thing that we can find, so obviously you can extract DNA, but also things like grains, starch grains from the food, pollen, seeds, phytoliths, which are these little sort of mineralized silica type elements from food, again, and from vegetable matter especially, fibers, animal hairs, parasites, bits of charcoal, all these things get trapped in the calculus for us to look at. So over the years, as we've developed this, initially just starting with looking at it with higher powered microscopes so that you can see what sort of pollens, for example, that can give you a clue to what sort of foods people are eating.
I'm sorry to ask so many questions. This is deeply fascinating to me. Would you expect to find in the record of the dental plaque to have sort of biological evidence of the locale in which the body is discovered? Or could you tell, for example, if someone had migrated from somewhere to somewhere else, that they might have a form of pollen that's not found in the place where their body is buried?
Yeah, so that is a possibility. So if there are certain things, certain types of plants, for example, that aren't local there, what you don't necessarily know is that food has been imported. But because normally it is the food that you're seeing as opposed to just environmental. You see, you do get environmental
you
things.
You and I, Richard, we don't have the brain of a scientist because I thought that was a brilliant question.
No, it is a good question.
I'm happy to be ignorant.
No, I know, but it's interesting. I'm not being facetious, actually. Kat's so analytical that she sees the problem straight away, where we just think, oh, that would be nice.
Yeah. Sometimes that isn't very helpful. I see a lot of problems that aren't really there, but that's fine.
But a lot to sort out, Cammy, because you can find all this stuff, but trying to find a narrative that explains.
Yes. So you've got to think about so many things. So the reason why it's especially useful that the calculus is because finding out what people ate in the past is actually quite hard. Because, of course, the organic materials don't last very well. So we get things like animal bones, and you can get an idea about that. But plants don't last, generally speaking, in the archaeological record. So there are certain ways. Sometimes we can find pollen, for example. But again, it doesn't really tell you if people ate certain vegetables or certain other plants. So this is a really useful way of doing that, because in today's diet, starch-based foods cover about 50 to 70% of our energy intake. So actually so much of it is from those sources, and they don't get preserved in the archaeological record. We can look at bones. So a lot of my work is looking at something called isotope analysis, where we analyze the collagen that's in our bones. But again, it just gives you the protein. So that's a small portion. But the calculus preserves all those grains.
Yeah, I'm
excited. Yes, I'm excited about it. So
one of the joys, presumably, I mean, it just can't be faked.
It's completely, and it's unconscious. There's no, you know, so if you look at, say, a skeleton in a grave and you try to interpret something about them and you look at the grave goods, so they've got a sword. That's all created. It's all, you know,
made. Decoration.
This is just what happens over time. So that is a really exciting part. And we've got some wonderful examples going back really far. So things like Neanderthals, for example, and finding out that they were eating lots of plant foods like date palms, legumes, grass seeds, for example. Really diverse diets, even able to see that they were cooked at times. So we know that people were cooking, you know, really that's early on. We can see use of marine resources again in some populations. And some of the oldest include lower Paleolithic hominids that go back all the way back to about 400,000 years before present. So the calculus is preserved all the way back to that period, showing again that they're exploiting a broad range of plant species. So one of those examples even had micro charcoal fragments, which have found their way into their diets and into their mouths. So that could either be because they are living in a smoky atmosphere in a cave, so you're getting all this smoke, all these little bits of charcoal in your mouth.
How far back are we now, Kat, in history?
400,000 years.
Blimey.
Which is quite staggering to think that we could find out that they were, you know, possibly even smoking food and getting the charcoal in from it that way, from the cooking
These are
process.
Our ancestors. Mm. Are they Neolithic?
Well, you can have Neanderthal blood.
So
can't
are
you?
We Neanderthal?
You can have it in your genes.
Most,
can't you?
So, yeah, quite low percentage. Yeah. They've found out now that there is mixing. but quite a low percentage. But these are, you know, going back much further than that. So we're finding out about general diets and how people use, but also things that we don't know about, which is things like specific plants, plant-based remedies. What did people use for medicines, for example, in the past? And again, going back to the Neanderthals, one study showed that there were remains of plants that have no nutritional value, things like chamomile. So you can sort of imagine, I'm visualising yes. these Neanderthals sitting around and drinking chamomile tea.
Oh, shocking day. I wish someone had invented Tai Chi, but it's still there. Yes. Until then, let's have some chamomile tea.
Yes, precisely. And we've got, you know, going much more recent, an 8th to 10th century AD study from Colonna in Italy, again showing pharmaceutical use of plants. So species that are used for heart conditions, species that are antiseptic and even have anti-malarial properties are being exploited by people
that
in the past.
That is fascinating.
It kind of makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah.
That if you are living your life, you will use the materials then to mitigate the things that make your life miserable.
Yes.
Right? Precisely.
But what I don't understand, Kate, build up of calculus, sometimes in big chunks.
Yeah.
No understanding of dental hygiene, no brushing of teeth. How does that happen?
It varies quite a lot. So that tends to be culturally sort of derived. And sometimes you just get a tiny bit. So I've seen some skeletons that are horrific and they're just absolutely covered. We don't really know why and who does what and where. This is one of those things, dental care, we don't necessarily know very well. So we just sort of prefer the ones who have got really bad dental care because then we get more evidence, really.
A bonanza for you,
isn't yeah, it? Exactly. It's much better. And then we get some other really quite fun things, which is also not really necessarily diet, but actually evidence about things like craftware or use of materials, because people use their mouth and use their teeth as essentially as tools, really.
Yes.
So there was one study, a Neolithic site going back to 9,000 years before present from northern Iraq, where a lot of small wood splinters and wood phytoliths were found in calculus. And the very specific shape and size of these fragments show that they're probably processing wood or reeds using their teeth, possibly using toothpicks as well. That's the other possibility for all these bits of wood, because they're not eating it.
It'll leave some evidence.
Exactly. So it leaves it in there. Cotton, again, a society in Ohio where they're finding lots of cellulose fibres from processing cotton.
I mean, I don't know. So is it unthinkable that prehistoric people flossed?
Definitely on toothpicks, we know. So in the Oseberg ship burial, the Viking ship burial, there's two women buried there, and one of them has these lines, these marks on her teeth, showing that she very likely used a metal toothpick, because we can
not
see
that. Not recommended.
No, but it means she didn't have a lot of calculus, so... But anyway, so disease as well. We've got evidence of disease. Leprosy, for example, ancient DNA can be extracted. So there's an example from Trondheim, a 16th century individual had the bacterium that causes leprosy. Meningitis has been found. A Roman woman from Tuscany had genetic evidence of celiac disease.
Oh, goodness.
So there's particular markers that are associated with celiac disease.
It's interesting because that's often associated as a sort of modern thing, isn't it? But in
there's a Roman period. She also had lots of signs of malnutrition, but also gluten-rich foods were found in the calculus. So obviously didn't know what was causing it.
So she was eating a high-gluten diet and...
Yeah. And she was very also evidence of herbal remedies in her teeth. So they were clearly
in the same lady.
Yeah. So she was clearly unwell.
Okay. Next question. Yeah. So you get a chunk of calculus.
Mm-hmm.
You stick it under your microscope, or you put it on whatever you get test isotopes with.
You can do all of those things. Depends what you're looking for, basically. So
but how do you pull all that discrete information apart and set it out and make a calculation about it or try and measure it?
You just need to get all the data. So you use however much, you probably take a small amount for each type of study, each type of method that you want to use. So you could look at it under a microscope first, perhaps, and then take it to a lab. You need very little, which is great. So for things like ancient DNA, it preserves ancient DNA really, really well, actually, compared to the other parts of the body. So that's actually a really useful one.
Because of the calcification.
Think so. I think it must be that, because it's, you know, it's very, very hard and very preserved well.
Fascinating.
It's also started to be used in modern forensics because drug use can be detected. Uh-huh. So there's evidence has been found of things like heroin, cocaine and opium in calculus. So either things that have been inhaled, or if it gets into the bloodstream and into the saliva, actually that can also get stuck in that plaque. Heavy metals get stuck in there as well. So things if you smoke, there's cadmium or things like that get stuck. It's a really interesting story from the 15th century. Agnes Sorel, who was the mistress of the French King Charles VII.
Yeah.
Her teeth were studied and she had a lot of calculus in her teeth. And they found a very high level of mercury, which indicated that she probably, that's probably how she died. And it could either have been, so a number of suggestions, one that it was a treatment for roundworms, known treatment using mercury. Women in labour as well, with difficult labours, were given mercury. But there's also a possibility, because it was such a high dose, it might have been foul play. And there's all these suggestions that she had too much influence over the king, so perhaps she was poisoned.
Taken out.
They use it for syphilis treatment, mercury as well.
Yeah.
But also, it could be benign. We got a portrait at home of a lady called Lady Venetia Digby. And her husband was an amateur chemist, gentleman, in the mid-17th century. And he tried to cure his wife with his own concoction with mercury added. And he killed her and, of course, was, you know, taken to task for doing so. But it was clear people just didn't know mercury was poisonous, did they?
No, it was considered a very, very good thing. And obviously,
well, it looks not realizing. So magical, doesn't it? Yeah. You probably think that must do some good.
Yeah. And I think in small doses, it can do good things, but...
Oh, really?
Well, poor old hatters, you know?
Yeah. Do you want to know my favourite fact? I mean, I've got so many, but...
I could do a whole season just on dental plaque.
But my favourite study, I think, was of a woman from Dahlheim in Germany, dating to the 9th to the 14th century. She was buried in a church or monastic complex. Looking at her dental calculus, they found lapis lazuli crystals in her teeth, or in her calculus, in over many teeth, separate episodes. Now, that's really interesting. What was that doing in her mouth? We also know this is a very valuable mineral mined in Afghanistan, luxury trade goods. It's used as a pigment. And of course, these religious institutions would create books and manuscripts. And this is one of the pigments that is very commonly used for a beautiful blue colour. So what seems likely is that she may well have been decorating and creating manuscripts, possibly licking the brush to make a point.
Well, that was really interesting.
So I think we're going to have to know now, who was this week's winner, please, Disembodied Voice?
Well, I'm here to give Kat something to smile about, because this week the winner is dental plaque.
Well, yay! That's brilliant.
So the winner's plaque.
Thank you.
Go to the plaque lady.
Get the plaque.
Well, richly deserved.
Yeah, I agree. That was lovely.
Thank you.
Well, lovely is the wrong word, isn't it? But it was really interesting.
So let's move on to next week and what topics we're going to be researching. So, Charles, you're going to be talking about boarding schools.
Hurrah.
Because you have a book coming out.
Well, I do, yes. So I'm going to lighten the mood.
Yes. Well, mine will be a little bit lighter because I'm going to be talking about skis.
Oh, yay. Home from home.
And Richard, this one again is going to need some explaining. County Palatine of Durham.
It's the County Palatine of Durham. I think it's about time we really explored that.
Yeah, I have been waiting for that, to be fair.
I thought you had.
Yeah.
Edge of your seat stuff. Yeah.
Every week the listeners ask us, when are you going to do the County Palatine of Durham?
This is a week, so.
Look forward to it.
Brilliant. Fantastic.
So, that's it for this week. Thank you, everyone out there, for listening. Please do subscribe to our podcast and leave us a review, because it really helps people find us when they're searching for a new podcast to listen to. And we love reading them as well. You can send us an email if you like, especially if you'd like to suggest a topic. rabbitholedetectives@gmail.com. So, in the words from Richard Adams' Watership Down, who likes an open, honest tale from someone he's deceiving? Goodbye.
Bye.
Thank you.